Lionel Messi is a Barcelona player no more. PSG's president insists they can fund the mega deal within UEFA's rules.
Always we look at financial fair play and always will fulfil the financial fair play regulation.
But with FFP changing, we'll tell you about the new rules being discussed at UEFA and how PSG's Nasser Al-Khelaifi is involved. And as the new season begins, we'll hear from the European League's organisation on FFP, competitive balance, and whether the Super League threat is really dead.
We have been living with the threat of the Super League during the last 20 years. I don't see why it should disappear for the next 20 years.
Plus, the doping fallout from the Olympics as sport a lot returns from Tokyo. Hello and welcome to the podcast digesting the best of the week's sports news with interviews and analysis. Coming up, we will be hearing from Alberto Colombo from the European League's organisation. We'll get all into the thick of the Messi transfer and how things are looking ahead of the new season. But we're now back for Sport Unlocked from Tokyo. And I'm Rob Harris from the Associated Press. Alongside me, as ever, Martin Ziegler from The Times.
Yeah, I hope you're not suffering jet lag too much, Rob. Nor you, Mr. Tariq Panjer from the New York Times. You're looking a bit sleepy there.
Just landed a few minutes ago, but obviously pleased to join you guys as usual. Nice to be with you again.
Dragged you straight off the flight. I came back far sooner after the closing ceremony via a brief evening at Club France to see the Olympic flag come straight from the closing ceremony to there, ready for its journey to Paris.
Yeah, did it get its own seat on the plane? They seem to have given it the full fanfare, that flag. Its trip from Tokyo to Paris, where it was going to have its lunch, all sorts of things. There was a whole day of stories about this IOC flag, and it kind of shows the kind of crazy world of Planet IOC and Planet Olympics. 3 more years to go.
At least it didn't have to get the various COVID testing. But testing very much in the news still, even days after these Olympics, because we've had the announcement of yet more doping results, and particularly one involving a British sprinter, CJ Ujar. Now, I was in the Japan National Stadium on the final Friday night of the Games when Britain looked like they were about to get gold in the 4x100 relay, and they were beaten by those thrilling Italians who've come from absolutely nowhere to dominate on the track. But the news about the British sprinter is that he's delivered an adverse analytical finding. He's tested positive, hasn't he? Martin, talk through the substances that he's tested positive for.
Yeah, I mean, this is potentially Britain's most serious Olympic doping scandal ever. It would be the first time in a Summer Games that somebody gets stripped of a medal. And to make it even worse, all his teammates, they would also lose their medals too, because that's the rules in a relay. If one person tests positive, everybody loses. So the substances are muscle-building anabolic agents. One is osterine and the other is S23. They're known as selective androgen receptor modulators, or SARMs. They were put on the banned list about 2008, and it's very much a sort of alternative. Bodybuilders use them as an alternative to testosterone or steroids. They may not be as effective, but they still work. And they are also contained in a lot of dietary supplements. I think from what I understand, British athletics have already been told he has no idea how they got into his system. But it's a really, really serious situation.
Sounds like he needs one of those expensive sports lawyers to get him off. And that seems to be the way these things go on technicalities. Do you think he's going to mention a burrito or a steak, a hamburger somewhere?
He's got, of course, the right to get a B sample, hasn't he?
That's right, yeah. There's going to be the B sample will be tested. And if they both are, then he's going to be found guilty. But you can still appeal. It can go to CAS. And often, as with these things, we found them, they can be overturned on a technicality, but hugely embarrassing and very disappointing for Great Britain. As Martin said, the other members of the team will lose their medals as well. And this has been a very strange track and field contest, we've got to remember. It's after the year of COVID, etc. The fast track, the new shoes. We saw a number of records broken. People coming from nowhere to win races and to set personal bests, etc. No one more so than the man who won the 100 metres, Marcel Jacobs from Italy. Remarkable performance in the final, 9.80 seconds. He only cracked 10 seconds a couple of months before the Olympics. And this week he announced he won't run again in 2022, which is a bit disappointing for those of us who'd like to see a bit more of him, because we'd not heard of him. He'd appeared like a comet, won the race like a comet, and he's disappeared just as quickly as he arrived. What do you make of that?
Well, he's probably gone off to spend his bonus, because Italian athletes get $213,000 for every gold medal. So he's got two of those. So he's probably going to do some Christmas shopping.
Of course, we've been able to come straight back into England without having to quarantine, just testing. But not such good news for the Australians, who have had to go through a mandatory 14 days quarantine on their return from the Olympics. And actually, some of them will have to go for an additional 14 days domestic quarantine if they've been staying out of South Australia and have to fly back in there from another part of the country. So pretty grueling reward for delivering success, isn't it, at the Olympics from Australia?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually enough to put you off being an Olympic athlete if you have to do that, because you're desperate to get home, desperate to spend time with your family, and then the COVID red tape means that you can't. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, if that is all the rules for people who've been double vaccinated, I think that's particularly harsh and almost incredible.
Flying into Australia isn't easy these days, but it is now far easier to jet across Europe, which is fortunate for Lionel Messi, who was able to hop on a plane from Barcelona, land in Paris on Tuesday, and complete his signing for Paris Saint-Germain. A transfer that in the space of the week happened, was resolved, and PSG were able to unveil their new player. Qatar was able to get its new footballing poster boy of the PSG project.
You're king of the segues today, Rob. Absolutely sensational.
Getting all the bonuses, the segue bonuses in some form of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it was always on the cards, wasn't it? From the moment Barcelona said they couldn't afford him, there was only one place he was going to go. It hasn't taken long for Visit Qatar to put him on their social media web page, has it? Showing him and other PSG players all very prominently saying visit Qatar. There's a whole geopolitical element to this, isn't there?
I mean, the strange thing is, when you actually go to Qatar, there isn't actually very much promoting tourism at all, yet Qatar tourism are very active in terms of sponsorship of the likes of PSG. Go there and you struggle to find the directions for anything to do with tourism. Tarek, you been there as well recently, like me.
You don't see any sign of it at all, to be honest with you. Very, very little sign of Paris Saint-Germain. I've just come back from Tokyo, as we talked about, and there's a Paris Saint-Germain cafe that's quite prominent in Shibuya. They're the main tourist district. I can't recall seeing one in Qatar while we were there. Certainly one that was particularly easy to find. There doesn't seem to be that much branding over there. But it's not about what's happening in Qatar, is it? It's about projecting Qatar to the rest of the world, to us in the media and to the wider world. And this is what happens. The players who were used alongside Messi are interesting as well. These were the coterie of summer signings. Donnarumma on a free transfer from AC Milan, massive salary. There was Wijnaldum from Liverpool, again on a free, massive salary. Sergio Ramos, Messi's great nemesis from his days at Real Madrid, on a free, massive salary. And Hakimi, the expensively hired right back from Inter Milan. They have really spent huge amounts. People are saying these are free transfers, albeit not Hakimi, but there is no such thing as a free transfer. The signing on fees are going to be enormous, whether in Bitcoin or anything else. Plus, the salaries are going to be astronomical. This is at a time when pretty much no one else can can buy players just takes PSG to a whole new level, where perhaps the only other teams that can match them for spending at that level are PSG's great rivals in England, Manchester City, also owned by an Arab sheikh or a ruling family in the Gulf at the UAE, and the oligarch Roman Abramovich, who started spending again at Chelsea. And that's pretty much it. Manchester United have spent two. But again, it's a whole different ball game when you compare them to these three teams. Where are we with all this now, guys? I mean,
they've had a lot of good fortune, haven't they, Paris Saint-Germain, in recent months, managing to get all these new recruits for absolutely nothing in terms of the transfer fee, while you've got Manchester United paying out more than £100 million on Sancho and Varane. You've got Chelsea paying almost £100 million to bring back Lukaku, who they didn't rate when he was originally their player. Obviously, Manchester City, the £100 million for Jack Grealish, maybe £150 million more on top of that for Harry Kane. So PSG have managed to get a few new additions while focusing their spending on either sign-on fees or salaries. And at the same time, it's been a few months when their boss, the president, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, has risen to the top of European football as the head of the European Club Association, thanks to the collapse of the Super League, which was engineered in part by the Juventus chairman, Andrea Agnelli, who did head the ECA, forced out that position. And now you've got him in this position.
Don't you think, seeing what City and PSG and Chelsea have done, doesn't that provide a little bit of the explanation as to why those Super League clubs decided to do what they want? They wanted partly better corporate governance as well. Yes, the project in the form that it was in was totally flawed, closed, etc. But you could understand why teams in Europe who aren't owned by sheikhs or oil men would want tougher regulations where maybe they can compete, not necessarily in the way they've done it by pulling the drawbridge up and closing it, but perhaps saying UEFA have had, 15 years of trying to do this. It looks worse than ever at the moment, doesn't it?
I do actually think that all these historic clubs like Real Madrid, Manchester United, Juventus, they seem that they've got some sort of divine right to remain at the top. They have put a lot of things into place within UEFA's existing rules to try and keep themselves there. Financial fair play was probably designed to keep them there as well. I actually think that I can understand the sort of distaste people feel when they think this is basically a sort of political exercise by Gulf states to give themselves some publicity. And absolutely, it is that. But I don't really hold with the fact that, poor old Real Madrid, poor old Man United, they can't compete, because they are just as guilty as anybody else of trying to sort of protect themselves.
So what's the logical conclusion here, though? So, yeah, everyone's going to be self-interested. Wickham Wanderers probably self-interested. Getafe will do what they want. But in terms of where we are today, with three teams being able to do pretty much whatever they want at the time of the pandemic, where everyone's kind of stuck, where is the end point of this? Because you look at those players that Paris Saint-Germain in particular picked up this summer, even before they got Messi, to what they already had. Where does this end? Is it like three teams playing each other and having a little competition? And the other thing is, where I'd ask for maybe some regulation is whether you like Real Madrid or Barcelona or not, these teams can't have capital increases at all in the same way Man United or even Paris or whoever, because they don't have an owner. You can't pour money into these teams. They have to generate cash and live within their own means, basically. Now, you could argue that they were taking advantage of previous situations and keeping themselves at the top of Spanish football or European football, but if a sheikh can just pour money in, that this is the end of the road for these teams, isn't it? Or for anyone else who can't just capitalize their business like that.
I mean, particularly also the French league as well. Just what does it do to the competition? People might think, oh, it's great. You're going to be excited by watching Messi each week. Well, certainly you just have to look at La Liga and say when they sold their television rights to 11 Sports a few years ago, having been on Sky, the interest just dropped off. There isn't necessarily the appeal to watch every single game of Lionel Messi, particularly when you've already got him in the Champions League and other occasions too. So it might overestimate actually the interest in just watching him playing for PSG in a league that they might run away with. Yes, they did lose the title last season to Lille, but you know, certainly things this season would point to a return of dominance, you would think.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, all I'd say is that in terms of regulation, things that would probably work in like a limit on transfer spending or on loan signings or all this sort of thing, UEFA can't do that. The only people who can really do that is FIFA, and so it's there's all sorts of issues around the European Union and whether that would be allowed. So it's not easy. I think if UEFA tried to impose some sort of regulation on the number of transfers or transfer spending, I think that would just fall foul of a legal challenge. So they're in a difficult situation. I don't know. I don't really know what the answer is. But I don't think there is an easy and obvious one. The salary cap, whatever it is, 70% or whatever it is of revenues, and then a luxury tax if you overspend that. It's not a bad idea. I don't think it's a particularly. It's not necessary. I don't think it's going to solve anything at all. You're right.
It's not a great idea in terms of solving the competitive balance issue. Because look, if we'd like drill down into this, if you're saying, okay, you can overspend as long as you pay a luxury tax, which I think MLB has in baseball in the US, and that money is then divvied up between the competing teams. There aren't that many of them. Here, you're saying you pay a luxury tax, and how many teams are playing in the Champions League? Would it be spread between them? That's not going to really move the needle at all. And then on top of that, you're asking, there's no pain, is there? Because the luxury tax is being paid by a club that is owned by state-owned entities that are the richest countries in the world. It's great for them. They'll pay the luxury tax as long as they can stay on top of the world, of course.
There are so many complexities in how you implement a luxury tax. Where does it get distributed to? Does it get distributed to every team in that competition, say the Champions League? So do you start with the teams that started out in the very early qualifying rounds? Do you limit it in some way or weight it towards those who are in the group stage or to those in the knockout stage? And if you imagine if it was towards the latter and teams from smaller countries, footballing wise, like Scotland or the Netherlands or Norway, and they got a slice of this cash from the luxury tax pool, then it could just distort things domestically for them. Say,
already has, hasn't it, Rob? Hasn't the Champions League already distorted those competitions? Forget the luxury tax. You look at those smaller, medium-sized leagues across Europe. They've been massively distorted by UEFA distribution. It's just going to distort even more. I just don't see the point of this. And also, 70% of what revenue? UEFA has been proven to show it can't really count revenue properly. You know, the investigators on its own CFCB panel have found money from entities that are linked to these clubs, and they can't be penalised for it. So what revenue are we talking about here?
Well, exactly, given how much revenue can be masked around these clubs in terms of where it's actually coming from. And, I mean, you know, we talk about those medium-sized leagues. We often talk about the big ones here. Just look at the country where UEFA are based, in Switzerland. Young Boys have won the last four league titles. Before that, it was a run of Basel winning the league from 2010 to 2017. So they only have to look in their own country where they're based, just in terms of what European participation can do to destroying the domestic competitiveness.
Yeah, that's always been an issue ever since the sort of Champions League replaced the European Cup and big money started. But that was brought in to fend off the European Super League, which raised its head in 1998 with the media partners. And that, as we know, that snake has reared its head again recently. So there's no easy answer. There is, unless Tariq is going to provide it right now.
Well, I think you mentioned it, and you said it is subject to a legal challenge. I'd take on the legal challenge. I think there's people in the European Union who are now frustrated with what's happening in football. And I think non-financial regulations governing the transfer market and squad sizes, etc., homegrown players, all these things, it's a competition. It's in sport, has a specificity element within European law already. The idea of stockpiling talent is opposed from FIFA down. I think the idea of limiting the number of transfers each team can do, the number of professionals it can register, you will have an interesting question about how that fits in with other European regulations like restraint of trade and free movement and all the rest of it. But equally, football moves millions of people around Europe. You saw what happened with ESL, particularly in England, with people marching into the street and the government almost legislating in the UK and England. So I think it's worth looking at. Otherwise, we're reaching an end point here where two or three teams can do whatever they like. And I think it's just annoying for everyone else, isn't it? Otherwise, you have a Harlem Globetrotters situation. It's not bad if that's what you want. Put all of the best players in one or two teams and watch them thrash everyone. They'll score some really interesting goals, might win 9 or 10 nil. It might be a different way of watching football. If that's what you want, let that keep happening. But if you don't want that, come up with something creative, regulate it, and then enforce those rules.
Let's listen to one of those people involved with helping to create the rules. It's Nasser Al-Khelaifi. This is what happened when the PSG president was asked about compliance with financial fair play at the unveiling of Lionel Messi.
We follow the financial fair play regulation from the day one that we started until the end. We're going to always fulfill the regulation of the financial fair play. Before we do anything, basically, you know, we look out with our commercial people, with financial people, with legal people. So as soon as, if you see that we're signing Leo, that means we have the capacity to sign him.
So Al-Khelaifi saying that PSG will comply with financial fair play, very much so on the basis of the vagaries of what FFP is now and what it will become. So of course he'd be saying they're going to comply with it. He couldn't say anything different, but perhaps his role is something that is coming even into sharper focus because he's got so many different hats that football does allow him to actually have. He's not only PSG president, he's on the UEFA Executive Committee, he's also chairman of the European Club Association, and of course he's the boss of beIN Sports, which is flooding so much cash into particularly UEFA through Champions League rights. So what do we make of this conflict of interest? Should one person be able to have so many jobs, or is it he just went with what football allows him to do?
There's nothing preventing him from doing that, is there? But it is almost remarkable that PSG have taken on this enormous, huge salary increase this summer, and it's going to be absolutely enormous. And the man who's going to have a huge say over the future of financial fair play or whatever replaces it is the president of PSG, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, and he's very, very well in with UEFA as well. As you say, sits on the executive committee. So, not surprisingly, lots of people not partisan towards Paris Saint-Germain are raising their eyebrows at his role in all of this.
Yeah, hugely influential, isn't he? I mean, as beIN, they're UEFA's biggest customer. What a strange situation where your biggest customer sits on your board. It's a really bizarre. I can't think of other parallels in other industries, but it just makes me think about governance in general in football. And I just think the whole model is broken personally. If you look at UEFA as well, it's the rule maker and it's also the competition organizer. So as the competition organizer with that hat on, if you want, it wants all of the best teams in its competitions or the ones that draw the biggest crowds and the ones that have the best players. So can you imagine if the biggest teams do break the rules, will the competition organizer want them kicked out? No, it wouldn't. So we're in this bizarre situation. We have been for years, and it's now coming to the fore as these things start bubbling up over and over again.
Of course, we do see in England how there is a separation between the regulator and the competition with the Premier League and the FA, but that has led to various clashes over the years and standoffs between the two due to that conflict. I think one of the striking elements is the way UEFA and FIFA's boards do operate, the fact that you can have Nasser Al-Khelaifa on that board. These boards don't have any independent members. It's the thing recommended in so many parts of business, something the English Football Association has introduced in recent years. Independent directors, those who can be outside checks and balances on the governance, and it doesn't exist. And one of the other frustrations that say articulate from within FIFA is the fact that the vice presidents of their board are presidents of the regional confederation. So Alexander Shefferin is UEFA president, sits as a UEFA vice president, and what might come into the decision making is whether or not to approve something like a bigger club World Cup. Well, of course, that then is a risk and threat to the state of the Champions League. So they're naturally going to resist it because their interests are towards the Champions League. So you get conflicts of interest as well in terms of someone like the UEFA president going to sit on the FIFA board.
Yeah. Again, to repeat, I just think the model's broken. Another guy who sits on the UEFA board is the La Liga president, Javier Tebas. Now, again, this is, to me, it feels very strange that these kind of guys who are, you know, ostensibly looking after another part of the game are sat within UEFA or FIFA. To me, it doesn't make sense. And you're right about independence. Who's looking at this? And Tebas is in the news as well this week, isn't he?
Yeah, we have an update from last week's pod on the progress of his bid to get some investment from CVC, trying to sell off around 10% of the rights to a new commercial venture that could last over, 50 years, as they hope to generate 2.7 billion euros. There's support from the clubs in Spain, but it's certainly not unanimous, and opposition has been led by Barcelona and Real Madrid. Real Madrid launching yet another court case against La Liga. There've been a lot, haven't there, in recent years?
Yeah, there's been about 51 court cases, Rob, involving Real Madrid and La Liga over there. So not afraid to seek legal action, as we saw with Super League as well. Real Madrid are the ones who are suing UEFA as well. It's actually interesting that Real Madrid, Barcelona aren't the only ones who are opposing this CVC asset sale, the 10% deal with CVC Capital Partners. Also, another member-owned club, Atletico Bilbao, have opposed this, and a second division team, Bilbao. So what we're talking about are three of the best-supported teams, three that generate the most TV income in Bilbao, Barcelona, and Real Madrid, opposing this project, which would hand over 11% of La Liga's commercial income, or what we're talking about, really their TV rights, for 50 years to these investors. And what La Liga are trying to say is, well, they can opt out if they like, and they won't have to give up their 11%, but then they won't see any gains from the investment. Now, I can't see how that makes any sense. How can you decouple growth in La Liga's business and its media rights in the future from Barcelona and Real Madrid being a part of it? I've got a feeling this thing could fall apart quite quickly because it's just too complicated without the two biggest teams. Mark, what do you reckon?
Well, I don't know. I'm just trying to work that one out. So what happens normally with these CVT things, they put a load of money into a league, for example, and all the clubs get a few million or however many tens of millions each shared across the board, and then they sacrifice a chunk of their TV rights in return. So if Barcelona don't and Real Madrid don't want to get, and Bilbao, if they don't want to get this cash injection, then they get to keep the full amount of TV rights. I can see mathematically it could work.
But La Liga is saying if the TV rights go up, that they don't share the benefit of it. Now, how would they be able to calculate the benefit of this deal moving forwards?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
I agree. Well, I think that's an impossible situation.
Yeah, it's an odd one.
And then you get Javier Tebas thrown into the mix that, well, if Barcelona had accepted the CVC money, then Lionel Messi would have stayed. So he's trying to sort of pit Barca against perhaps its own fans who are still ruining Messi's departure. But,
Some people would call that blackmail, wouldn't they, Rob?
Well, that's what it, could give the impression of being. And certainly the way this has been waged is very much Barcelona and Messi blaming La Liga. And, something that struck me is, in the discussion over the rights and wrongs of Messi's move to Paris Saint-Germain, is some of those perhaps bemoaning PSG and managing to work around financial fair play are almost willing La Liga to be flexible with its rules to allow Barcelona to be able to fund Messi's signing.
Yeah, ridiculous. You're dead right. It's people are very fickle, aren't they? When it's your club, you're happy to bend the rules, but if someone else is doing it, people are willing to ask them to be thrown out of competitions and the rest. And this is why none of the rules really change, because there's always a mob willing to support someone bending the rules. Now, to be fair to Tebas, he's held firm, whether for the right reasons or not, on the regulations that stipulate Barcelona need to cut its costs. Why should they be special? They clearly put themselves in a financial crisis, partly to do with COVID. But you can't only blame COVID, because no one else is in as bad a situation as they are. They need to cut their cloth accordingly. They need to reduce their salary wage bill. They knew the rules. All go say, what about the other four new signings they've made? This club that was in financial distress seemed to collect players. Now, this man, Mr. Laporta, he came in with this great image. He's just, to me, the first few months of the months he's been in charge, it's been a total nightmare. It's been a car crash. He's had the ESL. He's lost Messi. And now he's in this situation with La Liga. It just seems it's not going well for him.
Yeah, and the fact actually Tebas has risked, as has happened, losing the league's biggest name to preserve the integrity of the rules. Well, to get a perspective now on the bigger picture across European football, beyond just La Liga, beyond just Liga and Lionel Messi, we can turn to the European Leagues organisation and welcome to Sport Unlocked the Deputy General Secretary of the European Leagues, Alberto Colombo. Welcome to the pod, Alberto.
Yes, it's good. It's good after a long summer of sport with the Euro and the Olympics to focus back on league football. So thanks for inviting me.
So how are things looking as the league seasons begin? How concerned are you about the ongoing effects of the pandemic and generally the picture of European football financially in terms of the stability as well?
We are going to have already several leagues that are starting with the stadium with full capacity, not only in England or in France, talking about the big leagues, but we have leagues like Austria or like, the Denmark or medium small leagues in the Baltics or Switzerland, that basically they are starting with full capacity. Then every league, they have their own restriction. A few leagues are asking for COVID passports, the so-called green pass. Some other are asking for other level of restriction. But look, we have already basically one third of our leagues are starting with full capacity. And other probably they are using the first match days to test. But I wouldn't be surprised if before Christmas, we will have most of them actually playing with full capacity in terms of fans at the stadium.
Yeah, it's interesting, Alberto. I was speaking to somebody in your home country, Italy, today, who was saying it's only going to be 50%. So, I mean, when you compare the income that they're getting from the gates and compared to what's happening in the Premier League, where they're getting full capacities, I mean, that's a lot more income for the English clubs. So there's going to be a bit of a discrepancy, which it is probably quite challenging. But how soon do you think Italy, Spain can get up to these really high capacities?
I'm pretty sure that the Italian Serie A and the other leagues in Italy, they will also monitor what is going on in the other leagues. And we are there also to do it, to perform this monitoring and to provide information to all these other leagues. Because if the results that England and other countries, France and the country I've just mentioned, are going to be positive, this will also have a result in the other countries. And with no doubt, these leagues will also use these numbers, these figures and these data to negotiate with the respective governments.
The other big health matter is, of course, that of the players. They're playing so many games at the moment, with past year or so in particular. I was in Yokohama to see the Olympic football final when Pedri was playing his 73rd match in a year as he featured for Spain in their defeat to Brazil in the final. Is there just too much football? Do all your leagues need to just go smaller, cut the seasons to actually protect the health of players?
Yes, I mean, we are definitely concerned. The calendar is congested. And look, guys, this season will, and the upcoming two season, we are talking about the season that will be impacted by the World Cup to be played in November and December, will oblige to have a more congested calendar. Because, I mean, the FIFA World Cup in Qatar is impacting this season, is impacting next season, and let's see if it will be impacted even in two seasons. So there is no real space for postponement. There is no real space for finding new dates in case of whether it's bad weather or whether it is COVID issues. The calendar is super congested. And this is an issue that we are discussing with the other stakeholders. We know that there is the ambition of international organization to create their home club competition. And this ambition clash with the interest, and more important, with domestic football, you know. So it's important to find a balance, but yes, we are probably playing too much, but league football should stay where it is with the home calendar, you know, and it's probably the discussion should be done with the other stakeholders in order to probably try to avoid that this ambition to further expand the calendar that is already existing is going on.
So, Alberto, next month UEFA are going to launch proposals to replace financial fair play with a salary cap and a luxury tax. What do you think about that?
We are in favor of financial fair play, or let's say any measure that could increase the sustainability of football. And actually, we are also in favor to more strict measure instead of relaxing measures, you know, because especially in the middle of the of a crisis, it is better to have better control over cost than relaxed cost control mechanisms. So this has been always our position towards financial fair play.
We've seen this summer, Paris Saint-Germain have pretty much bought every expensive free transfer going, culminating in Lionel Messi. Manchester City have spent 100 million on one player, maybe 150 million on another. Chelsea have announced Romelu Lukaku, almost another 100 million pounds. These three oligarch teams, there seems to be no stopping them, whatever the rules are. Now, is that okay? You know, you're saying we need to talk about Super League, etc., and governance. Isn't UEFA supposed to be looking after European football? It seems to be allowing these three teams to do whatever they like.
I mean, these teams have let's say, the freedom to sign, and then I think that UEFA will have the responsibility to do it.
They haven't shown any responsibility so far. We've had financial fair play for 10 years. They haven't been able to enforce it against these teams at all.
I know, Dari, but what I can comment here, you know, is you know, we have to trust that UEFA is enforcing their own rules, and we are supportive of strict rules. You know, then of course, let's see also what will be the upcoming process. You know, there are. I mean, all these issues that we are debating are interconnected. You know, it is about financial fair play. It is about the huge amount of money that whatever clubs, not only the big ones, spend on salaries, and without talking about specific clubs, and the sustainability, the long-term sustainability of football is more on controlling costs.
I suppose the one big issue is around all this, is it healthy for any league to see one club, in this case Paris Saint-Germain, have all the best players, as it were, in that league, and it to completely skew the competition? It can't be healthy for a league that has one club so far and away with greater resources and able to amass the great players.
You know very much how we want to bring forward the issues of maintaining competitive balance in domestic football, whether this is at the European level or whether it is at the domestic level. You know, so once again, it is all linked and interconnected. It's about improving financial distribution. It's about increasing solidarity. Solidarity is another theme that thematic and subject that will be on top of the convention table. All these factors are interlinked. You know, it's about revenue distribution model, it's about licenses system, it's about cost control mechanism. All this is interlinked and has to be seen also together with the development of the competition, both at domestic level and at international level. But of course, I mean, we are concerned whenever there is a club, whether this is in Europe or whether it is a domestic level, that in March is already a champion. I mean, these are the last things that a competition organizer wants, because it's about the interest of the competition. It's about the interest of the fans, you know. And this is also why a lot of leagues, and without always talking about the Premier League or the La Liga or the big leagues, this is also why, if you look also at the report that we just shared, you discover that during the past 3-4 years, a lot of leagues have also implemented new formats, right? New formats in their own competition. They are implementing with creativity playoffs or other competition format to create the most challenging part of the season in spring, exactly because sometimes in these leagues there were clubs that in February or March they were already champions. You know, so it's about competition formats, it's about financial distribution, it's about licensing system in general. All this is interconnected and will be on the table of the stakeholder family in the upcoming month.
Is it naive to think the breakaway is dead? Surely the Super League will come back and you'll have to fight it off yet again. And when do you think the Super League threat will return?
I think, I mean, the way that has been presented is dead. But look, we have been living with the threat of the Super League during the last 20 years. You know, so that the fact that the Super League happened and it was dead in 48 hours, it doesn't mean that the threat would be there. But still, it was there for the past 20 years. I mean, I don't see why it should disappear for the next 20 years again. No, but this is just to say, we have been living with this threat in the past, since basically when it was 97, 98 for the first threat of the Super League organized by media partners, when a bunch of managers visited the UEFA offices. Look, 23 years after, we had the threat of the Super League materialized. But it's not because the Super League is dead that the ambition of the big clubs is changing. The ambition of big clubs is still there because they have a global audience, because their ambition are global, while the ambition of most of the professional clubs in Europe, I would say 95% of the professional clubs in Europe have only ambition that are domestic, you know, so that the ambition of this club do not change. But I guess that most of the big clubs now, they understood that it's better to work within the system. And because the same clubs are also playing at domestic level. We cannot forget that all these clubs, they have their most important competition at domestic level. The league is for all these clubs, including the very big one, their interest and major also revenue are coming from domestic football. So that I guess that they understood that they need to create an environment where they can develop both internationally and domestically, but they have to do these in respect of the world football community. And the world football community is done by and created by about 1,500 clubs in Europe, you know, and just 80 of them, they play UCC, you know.
Alberto, it's been great to get some of your thoughts on so many big matters affecting the leagues as we begin this new season. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Alberto Colombo there, the Deputy General Secretary of the European Leagues Organisation. And what a point to end things as we try to get over the jet lag, Tariq, from Japan, and something that's not affected you, Martin. But great to get all the thoughts and insights as ever in quite a varied and busy August week.
Yeah, great to see you back safely on British turf, guys. The Premier League starting again already.
Excellent. And, well, everyone enjoy the start of the various leagues in the coming days. And if you've got any thoughts, you can always message us on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook at SportOnLot. Email sportonlotpod@gmail.com. But for now, enjoy the viewing in the days ahead, whichever sports you're watching. And thank you for listening.